nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
We have senior research scientist Dr. Michael McLennan, who is the architect of Hub Zero. The Hub Zero project is, I guess we'll let Mike take it from here. We've already had a little introduction. So Mike's going to give a talk about Hub Zero. Please feel free. I'm sure he'll take questions as they come up and have more pizza. And there you go.
Thank you. Thank you guys for coming too. I probably wasn't me. It was probably just the smell of pizza in the hallway. But whatever it was is good with me. I'm always happy to have an excuse to talk about Hub Zero. I also wanted to just kind of recognize the Hub Zero team members that are in the room right now. If you guys are on the Hub Zero team, please just stand up. Yay! So actually, yay! The part of the reason I wanted you guys to see them is in case you have questions or you bump into them again on campus, then you'll be like, oh, those are the people responsible for, because they actually are the people responsible. So as Donna said, I'm Michael McLennan. I'm the director of the Hub Zero project, but there's a lot more people involved, and I want to kind of give you an overview today of what it's all about. So Hub Zero is, in a nutshell, it's an open source software platform that we've created that's available, that's used to build websites that are kind of focused on the academic mission. So research, education, and scientific collaboration. Some people call those websites like science gateways or collaboratories, but we call them hubs because we think of them as a kind of a focal point for the community. So in a nutshell, that's what it is, but that explanation really doesn't do it justice. So the best way that I can really explain it to you is to fly you through it and show you how it actually works. So again, Hub Zero is the software used to create all of these different websites that you're going to see, and those websites are accessed by people all over the world, photorealistically generated users, just like this one, all over the world, sitting in their sim homes. There's a hub for nanotechnology, NanoHub, that started it all. There's a hub for earthquake mitigation, that's the NICE hub, NICE project, one for pharmaceuticals, molecular diagnostics, and so forth. So you can see there's really wide range of all the different scientific applications and different kinds of communities that are developed, but all using the same software. There are now more than 60 of these sites that are running all around the world, and if you put them all together, it's 1.8 million people every year that we touched with Hub Zero software. So just to help you understand how it works, here's a group at Penn State. They had a class, they wanted to have a simulation tool available that did nanosphere optics properties. So they went to NanoHub and they chose upload, and of course the hub has you log in. If you're going to contribute something to a hub, you have to log in. But you can sign in with Facebook or Google or whatever. But anyway, they got started with the upload process choosing the tools option, and then it prompts you for some information about your tool. So you fill in a short name about the tool that'll be used in the URL, you can fill in a longer title, you can give people on your team, so you can say who's on the team that's developing this tool. You can say whether or not the tool is open source, if it has any export restrictions, and all that kind of thing. It'll create a subversion repository and a project area for you, for the tool, and it'll also give you access to this thing that we have called a workspace. A workspace is basically a Linux desktop that runs in the cloud that has all the Hub Zero software installed, and you can use it as a way of building new tools. Now, you can put up anything in a workspace. You can have a Java tool, Qt, MATLAB, whatever runs in Linux you can put up in a workspace. But a lot of people come to us and say, hey, I've got a Fortran code or some C code or some Python code. And what you're seeing here is this thing that we call the Rapture Builder. So the Rapture Builder lets you drag and drop controls. You can say, I've got a tool that takes two numbers and produces a curve. And maybe I want to add some HTML documentation in. So I can drag and drop that over, grab the HTML file. And again, with the Rapture Builder, you can preview what your tool is going to look like. So now I have a tool that takes two numbers and produces a curve that's like the absorption of the nanosphere. And on the tool panel, I can choose any language that this tool is going to be written in this case, Python. And when I go to save it, it'll have me save two things. One is an XML definition of the inputs and outputs, and then the other one is the actual skeleton program, in this case, a main program written in Python that acts as a skeleton. So now I look at that skeleton program, and there's all the gobbledygook that Rapture generates, but there's a comment in the middle that says, add your code here. So all you have to do is go into that spot and add in your Python code that actually does the physics using the inputs and the outputs at the top and the bottom. So now when I run it, I've got a automatically generated user interface that prompts me for two numbers. I click simulate, it goes off and runs the Python code for me. Now the last step in the process is to get this tool published. And so we have a whole environment that lets you look at the stage tool, preview it, see what it's going to look like for end users, and then there's a link that says my tool is working properly, I approve it. And when end users click that link, then it goes ahead and publishes that tool. So that's what the Penn State group did. They got their tool out there. And then across the pond, there was another researcher in the UK that was interested actually doing nanospheres in the laboratory, measuring the scattering properties. So he went to NanoHub and searched around for things like extinction efficiencies, and he found seminars and questions, and most importantly, he found that tool contributed by the Penn State folks. You see, it's got a title, authors, there's 600 users, two citations. It's an academic piece of work, right? But you can use it just by clicking Launch Tool. And when you do that, it connects you to this cloud session, a secure container, and this one's a little bit more advanced than the one that I built, but same idea. You fill in some values of material types and dimensions, you can change materials and simulate again. And if you simulate a bunch of cases, you can actually compare the effects of all the different materials on the scattering. And I can look at other properties like absorption or scattering or extinction and so forth. I can zoom in on the plots. I can mouse over and find out what's the optimum wavelength for that particular material and so forth. And if I want to, I can download that data too. So I just generated a bunch of data, and if I click download, it downloads it to my desktop. And that's what those guys did, and they actually wrote this paper that they published that compared their experimental results with the theoretical results on NanoHub. Now, back at Purdue here, Sylvie Broder has a data set that she wanted to get published on maize grain yields. And so she went to PER. PER is the Purdue University Research Repository. It's also built on Hub Zero. And if you log into PER, you can create a private project area for your research group. So you just give it a title again and a short name. So I'm creating the project for her right now, maize grain yields, giving it a name. And if you want to describe the project, you fill in an abstract and you can kind of say this is what the project's about in case anybody stumbles across it. You can add a little thumbnail image, which is kind of nice when you get about 50 projects. You can kind of tell at a glance which one's which by looking at the thumbnails. And there's an option at the bottom you can see that you can keep the project completely hidden, super secret, or you can make it so that anybody can see the description of the project. Of course, you have to be a member of the project team to actually get in to see the data. So I'm going to make this one so anybody can at least see the description. Now, I can invite people into the team just by typing their name, and if they've been on the hub, they just pop up. So I can just choose them and add them onto the project. But if we have collaborators outside Purdue, maybe at another school or someone who's never been to the hub, you can just put in an email address. So in this case, I put in, you know, johnqscientist@yahoo.com. That person will get an email message, and it'll invite them in to join the project. Now, one last screen. On PER, there's an extra screen that they inserted. The sponsored programs people like to keep track of who's doing what with their data management plan. So you can fill in a little bit of information about your grant, and then they'll keep track of that. And this is the project area. So this is a private space for anybody that we invited in. There's a Facebook-style update wall, so you can type messages out to the project team. And there's also a file repository, which is basically a Git repository with a nice web interface. And you can share data with other people on the project just by dragging and dropping files or uploading files in. So here I'm uploading a CSV spreadsheet file into my project. I'll choose another one. I'll choose a zip file. When you choose a zip file, it asks you if you want to expand the zip. And if you say yes, then instead of uploading it as a single file, it'll explode it into all the different files and directories. There's also a connection with Google Drive if you want to sync it with Google Drive on your desktop and all of that. Now, the really interesting thing is that you can take that data, like the CSV file, and turn it into an interactive database. This just took my CSV and staged it as a MySQL table. And now I can go ahead and edit the column types, add different comments, add units of measurement, and do all of this in the process of getting this data ready for publication. So I'm staging the data now inside my project, and I'll give it a name and a description so that other people right now in the project can see it. And eventually, after we work on it, we'll get it ready to the point where we publish it as an asset on PER. So for right now, this is just for the project team so that we can all work on it. And there's the link. You can see that it's based on that spreadsheet. If I ever update the spreadsheet, I can click Update Database, or I can delete that database. And anybody on the team that wants to see it can click on the link, and it brings up the latest data, just like that, so we can all look at it and clean it. Now again, there's a lot of work to do on the database, so we have a to-do list capability in the projects. You can create a to-do list item and assign it to someone on the team. Say, hey, there's some blank spots in 2010. Let's make sure we get that cleaned up. And so I can assign that to Ron Turco and give it a due date, and it'll show up in the project as something to be completed and kind of remind him about that. We can get into threaded conversations or conversations back and forth. He might say, where's the data? I can't find it in the project. And I say, oh, I put it in this folder. And we can talk back and forth about the to-do list item until finally we get it checked off and ready to publish. And all of that is captured on that Facebook style update wall. So you can actually have threaded conversations on the wall as well. You can see things that are happening automatically and so forth. Now I wanted to show you what it looks like on the other end of it, a published database. This is a team on the NICE Hub that went down to Haiti after the earthquake in 2010, and they took a lot of measurements related to the earthquake. And if you search for Haiti earthquake on NICE, you'll bring up their publication. That's the team. There's some pictures. There's some citation instructions. But if you click the button, it just brings you into that live table. So we can say, show me all the buildings greater than 6,000 square feet, and I want to see severe concrete damage. And so I can sort and filter, and I can see all the buildings that have the big buildings with the most damage. I can even bring it up and geolocate it on a map. So that's kind of in a nutshell what people are doing with Hub Zero. It's a way of publishing data, publishing simulation tools, and sharing those resources in a scholarly way with people all over the world. All right. If I only had 10 minutes, I'd probably be done. But I have a few more. You guys are still eating pizza. So I'll tell you a little bit more about the project, I suppose. Again, I mentioned earlier, it all started with NanoHub back in 2002. They got a grant from NSF to create this resource for the nanotechnology community. And it's grown and grown since then. Over the last more than a decade now, we're up to about 700,000 visitors every year now that hit NanoHub. 300,000 of them kind of stick around, use the site a little bit more than the others. You know, some people just bounce in, bounce out. But there's a core audience of 300,000 people working on NanoHub. There's 360 simulation tools that they built and contributed, like the one that I showed you, and about 4,000 other resources, seminars and files, teaching assignments, homework assignments, courses, all kinds of things. And it's been used by like 22,000 students all over the world as part of their educational experience. So it's really caught on. Now, in the timeline of things, you know, here we are back in 2002. We started working on this little website called NanoHub. And in 2004, we had 1,000 users. Woo-hoo! They were mostly at Purdue and mostly kids that were forced to use the site in class. So we started working on it. How could we make the tools a lot easier to develop and a lot more friendly? So in 2005, we created that Rapture toolkit that I showed you before that lets you take your Fortran code and turn it into kind of an interactive application. And we put that out there. And then within a little less than 2 years, we had about 60 tools. So we went from just a few tools to like 60 tools on the site. At that point, right about then, we spun out Hub Zero as a separate software package. We basically took the guts of NanoHub and we replaced all the places that it said NanoHub with Hub Zero and kind of made it into a generic thing. And we've been working on it ever since. Early on, we created Thermal Hub and Pharma Hub and Global Hub, and there was a site called Indiana CTSI. So those were among the first hubs that we created, but we've just been kind of going since then. Not too long after we spun out Hub Zero, there was actually an article that Review of Scientific Instruments that featured a NanoHub tool on its cover. And that's interesting because the Review of Scientific Instruments is about like instruments, like wires and things in the lab, right? But here was a virtual instrument that was available on NanoHub that simulated atomic force microscopy. So that made the cover, which was kind of interesting. So a little bit longer. Just before 2010, we got up to 100,000 users now on NanoHub, so it wasn't just the kids at Purdue that were forced to use it. People started kind of catching on all around the world. Not too long after that, NanoHub was featured in this Computing and Science and Engineering magazine, kind of talked about NanoHub and its impact, how it works. In 2011, we got a Campus Technology Innovators Award for Hub Zero as it started to catch on. And today, here we are, with 300,000 users on NanoHub, with about 60 other hubs running all around the world, and just things growing and growing. So that's kind of the history of how it all happened. And just to give you a snapshot of all of that, Here's a list of all the hubs. Again, NanoHub's the biggest one, the first one, the oldest one. But Nice is pretty close. Nice is actually a relatively new hub, just a few years old, and it's pretty close on the heels of NanoHub. 400,000 visitors every year that go to the Nice project. There's Habri Central, which does human and animal relationships like seeing eye dogs. There's PharmaHub for pharmaceutical manufacturing, Molecular Hub for molecular diagnostics, V-Hub for volcanoes, volcanology. So there's all kinds of different scientific disciplines represented here. And I just wanted to point out that NanoHub wasn't an anomaly. It gets a lot of users, but the other hubs do too, depending on their target audience and application. They all have thousands of people working on them, using them. All right, so we have it's like 27 hubs that we run here at Purdue, and because it's open source, lots of other people have picked up Hub Zero. So you'll find hubs at Indiana University and Clemson and Illinois and Notre Dame and all these different countries around the world. So people just grab the open source and set up their own hubs. And so because of that, we set up a separate foundation, a nonprofit entity called the Hub Zero Foundation. Hub Zero Foundation owns the Hub Zero code. So when people are contributing to Hub Zero, they're not contributing to Purdue, because God forbid anybody at IU would give anything to Purdue, right? Don't do that. Instead, we have the Hub Zero Foundation, which is an independent nonprofit entity that owns the code, kind of like Mozilla Foundation. And the foundation looks after the code and also promotes Hub Zero by having a yearly conference, and things like that. So, and if anybody's interested, if you people are using Hub Zero, it costs $5,000 to join the foundation, not a lot of money, and you get 20 hours of tech support. So a lot of people just say, hey, that's an easy way, if they're using the open source, to get tech support for Hub Zero. Now, I want to kind of focus a little bit. I told you already kind of how Hub Zero works, but I want to focus down onto our core areas, because whenever we add anything to Hub Zero, we always think about how it addresses either research or education, because that's really our mission. You know, we're not trying to create arbitrary groups or arbitrary features like Google or Facebook or Twitter might. We're trying to create things that actually address research and education. So I want to show you a little bit more of that. I mentioned already the Purdue University Research Repository, right? It's a data management solution, Hub Zero's institutional data management solution based on Purdue's institutional data management solution based on Hub Zero. So if you're writing a proposal to NSF or NIH or something, chances are you have to write a data management plan. A lot of professors say, what the heck is a data management plan? What am I supposed to do? And the answer is, well, go to PER. There's instructions about how to use PER as a data management solution. So a lot of people do that. In fact, more than 1,300 proposals have gone out of Purdue actually stating that PER is going to be their data management plan solution. And of those, some of them got funded. So there's about 469 active projects right now and more than 1,100 people at Purdue all using PER, average team size of about 5. And they're uploading files all the time, the number of things are growing. Now, so there's a publication process, and I showed you this in the video. You get into your own private group space, you have your own project repository, and you can interact with your team and to-do lists and create project notes and so forth. And the end goal of all of that is to put out these published assets that can get cited and that get used and you can get credit for. So when you're ready, you go through the publication process and you produce these various assets that come out. The assets might be databases, you know, like the MySQL tables that I showed. They might be compact models, if you're familiar with that, from electrical engineering. They might be molecular dynamics trajectories and what have you. So all kinds of different scientific artifacts. And they, again, get used in terms of research, and people use and evaluate those things and figure out how to make them better and write papers about it and cite those assets. Or they get used in education in the classroom. Now, I want to show you where we're going, because I think this is really what separates Hub Zero from a lot of other platforms out there that are claiming or purporting to publish data. You know, a lot of other places you can find data, and it's a file that you download or a zip file or something. And with Hub Zero, it's really different. You get a digital object identifier, so you can cite it. And, of course, that digital object identifier, you find it in a paper, you resolve it, and it takes you back to where you can get the data. But in this case, it takes you back to a hub. And the hub can do a lot more than just give you the file. So let me show you where we're headed with all of this right now. This is a little bit of a work in progress. We're still working out all the details with the publishers. So this first paper that I'm showing you, you're browsing around, you're seeing a paper, and there's an interesting figure. And this part of it is fake because this isn't really a paper with a DOI in it right now. But we're working out relationships with publishers so that when you encounter that DOI, it takes you to a hub. And this part's real. So the DOI takes you to the hub and brings up the data set in a live tool where you can not only just see the figure, but you can actually play through the molecular dynamics trajectory and examine the data, right? So here we are looking at that exact figure from the paper. Here's another example from the same paper where I can actually rotate the DNA or maybe grab the molecule and spin it interactively. So the point is that you're not stuck with just a movie or a picture or a file, but you can actually have this thing that you can interact with in real time. Here's another example. It's actually the movie of a DNA. It's actually, I can rotate this and move to a different angle, but it's basically a DNA strand going through a pore. And if I want to cite it, again, there's citation instructions. I can download the BibTeX and put that in my file, or I can download EndNote and throw that onto my bibliography. So there's the citation part of it. Copy and paste that out. Or I can download the data. If I want to, I can get the data and bring it down to my desktop. But this application helps me understand, do I want all the data, just the data for this one scene? What do I want to download here? So I can actually look at the data and kind of try before you buy in terms of what you want to download and then eventually bring it in. Uh-oh. Red alert. So that's where we're headed in all of this, right? Is it not just an FTP site, not just something that you download, but something that you can actually use and interactively explore? Question?
Yeah. How they have, typical molecular dynamics trajectories, large.
Large.
And for a typical paper, you have lots of them.
Right.
So how do you...
Yeah, question is, how do you handle that in terms of a typical molecular dynamics trajectory that's really large? And the answer is, we're working on that. There are mechanisms out there, right? Like, people use Globus, and it's a problem. People use Globus to do file transport between endpoints, and that's something that we're working on right now, trying to figure out how we can leverage their API to do parallel FTP. For medium-sized examples, it's not too terrible to actually download it. So there, in general, in Hub Zero, there's a variety of strategies that we try to employ. I showed you earlier in the projects, there's a file browser where you can upload stuff directly into the project, but you can also SFTP things into the project, and you can connect it through Google Drive onto your desktop and so forth. And Globus is another one of those things in the toolbox that we're trying to add into the solution to give people options.
So you don't have a supercomputer for your backend?
We sort of do. Thank you. Let me explain this part of Hub Zero. So Hub Zero actually runs like a web server and its own server, but it has connectivity to all kinds of different resources and computing things. So people out there that are doing research like to use these programs like LAMPS and NAMD and ABINIT, BLAST, and so forth, and those things all require significant computational power. But the good news is that Hub Zero has connectivity into all of that. Hub Zero has a command called submit that you can, you can use the submit command in Hub Zero to send your job out to a variety of different clusters and grid protocols. You can send things off to Exceed through PBS or Globus. You can talk to Condor pools like Open Science Grid and Diagrid. You can connect to Red Cloud at Cornell. There's even a connection to Boink, which is the volunteer computing thing that people can install on their own PC and accept jobs for free. So Hub Zero gives you connectivity to all these different research backends. We leave it up to each hub to actually make the allocation request, broker the deal, figure out what they want to include and what they don't. But Hub Zero has all the options. It also all the Purdue clusters. If you want to hook in all the different clusters we have here, Carter and so forth, you can connect those into Hub Zero and make those venues for your computing as well. So, question? No. The question is, do you have to authenticate? And the answer is, you have to authenticate as a user, for example, of NanoHub. But once you're logged into NanoHub, everything else happens automatically from there, transparently. So anyone in the world can go through NanoHub's queue onto their allocation and submit things in. And typically, people don't even know that they are doing it because they're bringing up a tool, for example, like Nanosphere Optics. They're setting some properties and they're pushing a button, and that actually generates a job that's being sent off, for example, onto Purdue supercomputers that we have here, or out to Diagrid or Boink or Open Science Grid and so forth. So yeah, it's basically democratizing access. And through the, you know, for example, for NanoHub, it's Gerhard Klimek and his grant that actually funded the nodes that are, the jobs are being sent to. So he is basically purchasing, or you could say Gerhard and NSF are purchasing that hardware and providing access to the world. Again, based on geographic restrictions and things like that. If there's a tool, for example, that, you know, can't be run in Germany or something, there are export control restrictions that you can put on top of things. But if things are open, they're open.
And those grants also pay for the licenses?
Yeah, the question is, do those grants pay for the licenses? And the answer is yes. A lot of grants tend to leverage open source software. So for example, Octave instead of MATLAB. But for grants like NanoHub, where they actually want to use MATLAB and they have to provide access to users, they purchase licenses to do it. That's exactly right. So we have this whole infrastructure now that now your job doesn't have to fit on your desktop, and it also doesn't have to fit on the hub. It can actually go from the hub out to all of these other computational venues. And the submit command, for example, you can send off 1,000 jobs. You can say, these are all the different input parameters that I want to run. I want to run 1,000 jobs. And the submit command will create a Pegasus workflow automatically and dispatch your work across Diagrid, for example. Manage all those jobs and bring them back. So there's a lot of computational power here that you can leverage and make use of. Some people do that directly within a workspace, like I showed you before, and other people build it into tools so that other researchers can use it without even knowing anything about it. And some projects actually build that, like kind of make it, use Hub Zero to make that front and center. So for example, the Diagrid hub that Carol Song leads, that's actually a hub based on Hub Zero that gives you access to the Diagrid cluster. So you can go onto Diagrid and bring up the BLAST tool, and dial up your parameters and push a button and farm out a bunch of jobs on Diagrid all at once. And you don't have to know anything about Diagrid. You're just dialing up parameters and pushing a button and you get your results back. Now, one other thing that Hub Zero does is on, with respect to education, we have a whole platform built into Hub Zero for handling MOOCs. You know, these are the massive open online courses like you'd see from edX or Coursera. So you can get into any hub and you can build courses and deploy them. And the courses have hands-on assignments, discussion forums, gradebook, and so forth. And again, I want to show it to you because I think it's spectacular. So here I am on NanoHub and I'm an instructor on a course. And if I click build outline, I have an empty outline, but I can start to add units. Units might be like week one of the course or module one of the course. And in that module, I work on the Rapture Toolkit, so my course is all about Rapture. I'm going to add in now a lecture into the module one, and I can just drag and drop my video files in, or my PowerPoint slides, or my course notes, or any of those things. So I'll drag and drop next my PowerPoint slides. And you notice while it's doing that too, whenever we upload anything onto the hub, we have a lot of security built in, so we do virus checking and all that kind of thing, because we don't expect our users to be well behaved. So you can get into the outline and rename things. I rename the lecture and the slides. I can add a homework assignment. Again, I can take a PDF and drag and drop that in. Turns out a lot of professors have been teaching the course the same way for years. They have a lot of things like this, Word files, PDF files, assets like that. You notice it was asking me if I wanted to upload it just as a plain document or as a quiz. I'll show you what the quiz thing is. If we're going to make an exam, and again, I've got an exam that I had written previously in Microsoft Word, if I drag and drop that in, this time we'll say create a quiz or exam. And when we do that, it'll upload the document and render it for me. I can give it a title and I can say how much it counts for. It counts as an exam for this course. And if I drag out a rectangle, I can lay down radio buttons right on that document. And the beauty of that is that I can have all these embedded figures, I can have equations, I can do all kinds of complicated things that I'm used to doing in Microsoft Word, but I can basically turn it into an online quiz or exam instantly. If you guys have ever used edX, it's a different world. You have to work pretty hard to get your quizzes into edX. So this is what a finished product looks like. I can go to a lecture, I can click on the video, it brings up the video with the slides and in the instructor. There's even the way that this video was produced, there's actually a table of contents. I can click on the table of contents and jump right to that part of the lecture. And right down below, I've got my discussion forum integrated. So if I have a question about this lecture, I can just add it right there, generate a discussion item, and there's a thread for that particular video. Also, for the homeworks, we integrate simulation tools. So part of this assignment is to run this tool called OctaView, which basically brings up a MATLAB script, and you click the button and it runs it. Again, this in this case is not using MATLAB, it's using the open source Octave, so we don't have to worry about licensing. But I can actually fiddle with the script, I can plug in different values, I can tweak the script, it might be that I'm supposed to update the model as my homework assignment. If I have questions, I can go into the discussion forum and interact with the instructor. And there's also kind of a progress page, so you can see, you know, where I am in the course, what I've finished, what I have yet to finish, what to do. So there's a lot of capability there, and again, directly addresses the education space that Purdue's interested in. There's two projects here using this. There's NanoHub U, which has 13 nanotechnology courses, and also Purdue Next that has 24 courses. So a lot of usage, and any other hub can take advantage of it too. In fact, we see a lot of projects that want to use the courses just for simple things, like how to gown up before going into the Burt labs or something simple like that, not necessarily academic credit. All right, so maybe at this point you're saying, all right, I'm sold. I'm interested in Hub Zero. What do I do? What's next? Well, first of all, as I mentioned before, it's open source software. So you don't need my permission. You can just grab the software, create a hub, and have at it. And a lot of people do that. We find hubs all the time on Google that we didn't know were out there because people just grab the software and start using it. We have Debian packages. We have Red Hat packages. We have VMware images. You can just grab stuff and get a hub up and running very quickly. Now, some people do that, and then they run into trouble. They're like, uh-oh, I need some help. So that's why we set up that Hub Zero Foundation. They can join for $5,000 and get live chat access to the Hub Zero team. They get 20 hours of tech support. So that's a great way for them to get tech support and for us to support the Hub Zero community. And some people say, well, I don't want to mess with all that. I want a hub, but I don't want to mess with it and keep it up and running. So they basically have us or another company do the hosting for them. We do it here at Purdue through our team, but there's also a couple of other teams out there that are companies and so forth. There's Incubed here at the Purdue Research Park. There's No Innovation as a company, and there's another company called BioTeam that all offer different services around Hub Zero. So you can engage with lots of different people to get services. Very typically, people will say, hey, need one of those hub things for my proposal, and we'll work with them and become like a sub-award or something in somebody else's grant or a piece of a Purdue grant where we provide the hub and a little bit of customization as part of the grant. And we have a whole team to do that. There are 27 people now working on Hub Zero, 27 full-time staff. I'm not counting students, and I'm not counting people that just do the Hub Zero for part of their time. It's 27 people. They're funded by all these different projects. We have 25 different projects that use Hub Zero in one way or another. And so all of that money, all put together, and all of that staff time from all of those sponsored research projects funds the salary of all these people. So their job is basically to do Hub Zero as well as they can. And they're all different roles, too. There are some people that are just focused on support and operations. Customers call, tickets need to get triaged, training materials need to get developed. There's people that do that. There's people that work on the web and create new capabilities that way, or on the middleware or high-performance computing connections. There are people that work on the scientific visualization and Rapture Toolkit and so forth. So there's a whole team of people here that are just living and breathing Hub Zero, and, you know, just doing whatever works for other people. We set it up as a recharge center, so anybody who needs Hub Zero services can just come. We have standard prices for what it takes to run a hub, for what it takes for staff weeks. So you can just come and pick items off the menu, say, I need this and a little bit of that, and we put together a project, and we work on it. And it's worked out really well. I'm very happy to see all of that. And you guys saw earlier the staff that's involved that stood up. It's really all of their great work that makes this possible. So again, how does Hub Zero get developed? Well, you know, there are projects like NanoHub that needed the courses component, so we worked on that, and now everybody has courses as part of the software package. PER created as part of that project, we were funded to build the projects and the publications. So we created that capability that you saw in the video. We put that in Hub Zero, and now all the hubs have access to that capability. So every little project that we work on, we worked on a security card authentication thing for the Air Force. They have these secure smart cards that you have to use to log into a hub. We added that in. That's part of Hub Zero now. And all the other hubs that might need that, all have access. So in general, as we add things, we put them into the open source release and everybody benefits, which has been really a terrific way to get momentum. A second way that we create Hub Zero is with all of these sponsored projects. And you know, I don't even lead these things necessarily. I'm so happy to see all my colleagues. So Carol Song has an NSF grant right now, a DIBS grant, that's adding geospatial capabilities into Hub Zero in the Rapture Toolkit. That's her award and her project, but I'm so happy that she's doing that because it kind of adds the capabilities onto the platform. And Christine Catlin is a co-PI with Santiago Pujol on this other DIBS project. She created all the database capability that you saw, being able to take a spreadsheet and stage it as a live database and all the mapping stuff integrated into that. Her team built all of that, and she has this proposal that they're working on searching databases and adding those capabilities. Mike Zentner has another project that's involved with Science Gateway Institute and how we can kind of, you know, deal with other people that are trying to build science gateways. So I'm super happy to see all of these people leveraging Hub Zero and kind of, you know, benefiting from it, but also adding things back to the platform, kind of helping move things along. And also the third way that Hub Zero gets developed is that anybody in the open source community can create something. So like you, if you guys are aspiring developers, you like to hack code at night, you can get in and create some PHP code or something. You can contribute it to the Hub Zero Foundation. There's a little bit of paperwork. You have to assign copyright of your contribution to Hub Zero so that Hub Zero takes ownership of the copyright. And then we also have an approval process. We have a team that reviews and approves things. And assuming that your contribution's approved, it goes into the next release, the open source release of Hub Zero. You go up on the wall. We have a wall of Hub Heroes. And we have an event called the Hub Hero Challenge, which we run from time to time. It's kind of our hackathon event. So whenever anybody comes to the event or contributes something to Hub Zero, they become a Hub Hero and they get up on the wall with their contribution. We have about 20 people, I think, on the wall right now. So we're kind of growing the open source community. And we have a yearly conference too. Now you're hopefully rabidly convinced that Hub Zero will change your life, and you can't wait until the next opportunity to do more with it. This is probably your next opportunity. This was our conference last year, in September and October of 2014. But we have an annual conference called Hubbub, which is our Hub Zero conference. This year, again, it'll be around September or October of 2015, and we're starting to plan it now and pin down the dates. And it's basically a conference, usually draws about 100 to 120 people. So lots of people coming from all over the world, typically, that are using Hub Zero and trying to learn how to use it better. And we get great invited speakers. These are our invited speakers from last year that are all really well-known people in the cyber infrastructure world, coming to talk about Hub Zero. So if you're interested, keep an eye on Hub Zero website. We'll have announcements coming out about Hubbub 2015 pretty soon. And by the way, I'll put up we have our Twitter and our Facebook handles. So if you like Twitter or Facebook, you know, follow us and you'll get all those announcements about things that are happening with related to Hub Zero or about the conference coming up. And I wish I had more time trying to keep it short for you guys because there's only so much pizza and so much attention, so much time. I could go on for a long time. There's a lot. I scratched the surface of Hub Zero. There's about 40 components in Hub Zero that all do different things, and I got to show you a few of them. So there's a lot more there that we can support. And if you're interested, I welcome your questions, and I thank you so much for coming today. Thank you. Questions? Yeah.
Yeah. So, can you give a little bit more information about the early publications? I thought that Flutter was just a repository, but how
Hubgate
then gets incorporated with Hub Zero exactly?
So PIR, the website, is an instance of Hub Zero. It's built on the Hub Zero software. So if you wanted to create an exact replica of PIR, you could take the Hub Zero software and set up your own website. And if you made the template look the same, it would look like a replica of PIR. All of the functionality of PIR is Hub Zero. And we've developed that jointly with the libraries, with sponsored programs. But again, after developing all of that, we rolled it into the Hub Zero core, and now all the hubs have the same capability. So in the same way that you can create projects on PIR, you can create projects on NanoHub or projects on PharmaHub. In the same way that you can publish data sets on PIR, you can publish data sets on NanoHub, publish data sets on PharmaHub. So Hub Zero is the software that powers PIR. And it's an ongoing project with us and the Purdue Libraries. We've added, I didn't show you much of the publication process. I showed you how you get into projects and how you work on data. But there's a button you can press to say start a publication, and it starts prompting you for your title, for your authors, for your abstract. You choose the files that you want to publish, kind of go through configuring all of that. You can add images and get everything ready, you know, your sponsor information, all that stuff. And then you preview it to see if you like it, and then you choose your license, for example, Creative Commons or whatever, and then you push a button submitting it. And then there's a whole curation workflow that we built. On the PERS side, they look at that and they say, there's a problem with something you submitted, and they'll kick it back to you. And then you can look at it again and fix it and remediate it and submit it again. And so there's a whole curation workflow that we built that I didn't have time to show you, but that helps you through that publication process until finally the PER guys look at it and approve it. And then it becomes a published asset with a digital object identifier that anyone in the world can see, they can download, they can use, and most importantly, they can cite it through the digital object identifier. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Yeah, but how much would it cost you just to publish the data?
How much would it cost you to publish the data? So PER is completely free. It's subsidized by Purdue, right? So Purdue University pays the bills for PER and offers it as a free service to the Purdue community. They do say there's limits. There's a certain amount of disk space that you get for your default project. And if you register your project with sponsored programs, the way I showed you, fill out a little bit of information, sponsored programs will automatically bump you up to a larger size. If you need more beyond that, then you can purchase in your grant additional terabytes. So you might say, look, I need 10 terabytes of storage for my publication. You can actually build those charges into your proposal, and you can pay PER a one-time charge to publish your 10 terabytes of data. And all that information is on the website, so hopefully it's self-explanatory. Sure. Other questions? Yeah.
The threshold to get involved in Hub Zero seems to be fairly high at the cost of it. And so if you've got people that are, you know, we're trying to convince some of our faculty to use these services, which I think are great, but they're like, well, it's easier to just, you know, do a local web server on something to start with, and then they don't know whether it's going to grow or not. And
they're wrong.
They're
wrong. They're wrong. They're completely wrong. And the great thing, the first few myths that I can dispel.
I do support for these people, so I'm aware of a lot of the myths there. But
yeah, so number one, if you don't want to spend a dollar, you don't have to. You can put all your money in sweat equity. It's free. It's open source software. You can take a VM this afternoon, set it up on your laptop, power it up, and start fiddling with a hub, right?
Links to the clusters and to the diagram and all that.
But you can add all that. If you have a cluster, then you add that in and so forth, right? So, I mean, again, you can talk to Diagrid or put in an allocation proposal on Open Science Grid or use Boink, which is completely free. And, you know, as you integrate those things, they're, you know, it's sweat equity. So you're doing the work to configure the hub. Now, if you were doing that just for yourself, it would be a whole lot of work to do just for yourself. But if you're trying to build a community like NanoHub or PharmaHub or something, it's worth it for the community. So the dollar amount is really not there. I mean, you can say, I'm going to pay $0 and do all the work myself, or you can say, I don't have time to mess with it, I'm going to pay these guys to do it for me. But there is a certain amount of work in terms of creating the hub. But you know what? There's a certain amount of work in terms of them creating their own website. And depending on how they do it, you know, if they just put something up on Blogger or whatever, you know, Google code or whatever, no big deal. But if they're trying to set up their own Apache web server and run it and keep it patched and keep it secure, it's more work than they think it is to actually keep it secure. So, the question, I guess, and where we see it really resonating with people is when we have projects that require for example, HIPAA or FISMA or just some kind of, you know, security, they really appreciate the fact that there's a hosted hub solution and they don't have to worry about it, then it resonates with them. And so we try to accommodate all sizes, everything from completely free up to moderate size hubs up to something that's really big like NanoHub. So I think there's really a sliding scale there.
Do you have any groups on campus that are doing this, say a department that is doing their own
For example, we have an instance of Hub Zero right now for the Purdue Polytechnic Institute. In the past, we've had an engineering hub, and we've done a few different things. So, and sometimes people whether they knew it or not, they were using Hub Zero because they're using PER. So PER is a great example, right? Or Purdue Next. Purdue Next is also a hub based on Hub Zero, and if people are going there and taking courses, or if the Purdue Next people are letting you put up your own courses, then you're using Hub Zero whether you know it or not. So in the cases where, you know, if you have something nanotechnology related, you don't have to pay a dime. You just go to NanoHub and you put it up. If it's pharmaceutical related, again, just go to PharmaHub, create a group, create a project, put it up, right? But when you're starting your own hub, that means starting your own community. There's actually a lot of work involved, whether people know it or not. So it's more than a website. I mean, people think Hub Zero is a blog, and it's not. It's not a blog. If you want a blog, definitely use something else. Other questions? Yeah.
Without giving away, you know, all the trade secrets, what's the future? What's the vision of kind of where we're going in the
with Hub Zero? Yeah. So every time we solve a problem, it seems like three more appear. So what I showed you right now, you know, we got into PER and we did some data publication and we got to the point where we were publishing files, but that's not good enough. So now we're taking the tools capability of Hub Zero and letting people create their own viewers and data managers that integrate into the publication process, kind of like that molecular dynamics visualizer that I showed you. So there's a lot more that is going to happen in terms of the data publication space, in terms of making that more interactive, and in terms of not just having one file-based solution, but imagine hundreds of tools out there that people create themselves to publish their own kinds of data. And that allows you to specialize the data out in very amazing ways. If you guys have seen the NEESE project at all, the Earthquake Engineering Hub, they have a tool called Indeed that they use inside their data warehouse, which is a fantastic tool because, again, you're not just downloading files. You bring up schematics of an experiment. You can choose sensors and plot the results from the sensors. And that kind of manipulation of data is fantastic. So we're building a toolkit to allow those kinds of things. You know, the mapping stuff that Carol is working on and all of that is kind of related to data publication and exploration. The NanoHub folks are also adding in a capability called uncertainty quantification, which allows you, if you could, you know, in real life, if I were to fabricate nanospheres, they're not exactly a certain size. They're like a certain size, plus or minus, there's some standard deviation or something in the sizes that I'm generating. So when somebody runs a tool like that, they really want to say, I have a mean radius of 5 nanometers with a standard deviation of 1 nanometer. And what kind of optical wavelengths am I going to get out for that? Because that's real life. So we have a way now in Hub Zero of managing uncertainties like that. You can specify probability density functions for the inputs. You can run hundreds or thousands of simulations, and you can get back aggregate statistics that tell you how the system is going to behave in real life, accounting for all those uncertainties. And of course, that demands a lot of CPU power. So that's why we're working on Boink and all the other connectors to all the different things that let us have CPU. And then there's just ongoing collaboration things that we're always doing, finding new ways of letting people put information online. We have a thing that's a lot like Pinterest, where you can share information, but it's kind of a Pinterest clone for scientists. So that's there. We're working on a storefront, because a lot of these hubs, when their grant ends, they don't know what to do. Everything's shut down, the money's done, what do we do? So right now we're working on a way of incorporating a storefront into hubs so that, for example, NanoHub can offer memberships, or another hub can offer t-shirts, or software. There are some hubs that want to offer commercial software and get a cut of that, and they're working out deals with different commercial companies. So we're working on that effort as well to add in a paywall and help the hubs sustain themselves through kind of an app store model. Lots more to do.